Give glory to God, our light and our life.
You're listening to the recordings of sessions from the Institute on Liturgy, Preaching, and Church Music in July of 2024, hosted by Concordia University, Nebraska. If you'd like to learn more about past LCMS worship institutes or about those that might be coming soon, visit lcms.org/worship-institute.
Welcome this afternoon. My name is Benjamin Kaloji from Dallas, Texas. And this afternoon, we are going to be talking about a project that I've recently started. And I've titled this Faithful Practical Musical, Profiles in American Lutheran Church Music. And I need to preface this by saying how this started. Several years ago, if any of you know Connie Seddon, who was involved with Concordia Historical Institute, and her father was Walter Buzin, whom you musicians may know. Walter Buzin and Theodore Graebner, who was longtime editor of the Luther Witness and other things, Lutheran Herald, back in the 30s and 40s, he and Buzin had decided that they were forgetting the history of Missouri Synod music in America. And there's a quote in one of the letters that says, I think Buzin says, not all of these Lutheran musicians deserve to be remembered, but some of them do. And I think the point was that they're all being forgotten. And maybe it would be best to put them, give them to posterity and to research them. So the idea was, Graebner and Buzin, this was actually like 1946, they were going to publish little paragraphs on significant living and deceased Missouri Synod musicians in the Lutheran Witness. Well, that eventually became a committee of Buzin and Graebner and other people, and with all things committees, you know what happened. Nothing happened. So this archive came to Connie Seddon, and it eventually worked its way to me. And so I've taken the framework that Walter Buzin and Theodore Graebner established in the 1940s, whom they were to include. And they also wanted to include portraits of these people, which I thought was interesting, because it's more than just situating these liturgical musicians or pastors in the context of American history, American sacred music history, but it's also kind of getting to know them as a person. I mean, when I die, I don't know if anybody will care or remember, but you know, they'll know that I'm an organist. But will they know about my malty poo that I really like? No, they won't know that. You know, but that's a part of me too. So my idea has been to paint pictures, personal, theological, liturgical, the significance of these people, but using the framework already established. So that framework being who these people were. So I have taken, there's 13 of them that kind of came down to me, and I've been working on them, and it will be published one way or another. We're moving pretty close to that, but this is kind of where we are. I'm going to deliver this to you today. But I have to say, this is very heavy on the early part. This lecture, my ultimate book is not, because there's a lot of people in the mid to late 19th century that we have forgotten, and 20th century that we've forgotten. And I'll cover that, but maybe less so today. And the reason why is because even though there's been so much work on the Saxon immigration and C.F.W. Walter, I mean, there's so much stuff on him, we don't need more research on Walter, but we actually kind of do, because I think he set up the ethos of the Missouri Synod in a certain way that has profound implications liturgically and musically. And John Vicker has done some good work on that, but I think there's a ways to go. So I'm going to be heavy. So when you see us and we're not making a lot of progress, and we're still on Valter, it's okay. That's the plan. We're not going to go for 5 hours. So we are going to look at the first century of Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod Church Music in America, exploring the evolving role of vocation in the cantor, church musician, teacher roles in from their training, musical instruments, important congregations, compositions, and notable individuals. Now, we all know about the immigration, of course. The first immigrants sought to recreate in America their spiritual life in Saxony, bringing with them theological literature, a complete set of band instrument scores, pianos, and even a pipe organ commissioned in Dresden. Now, Theodor Grabner wrote this. He said, the Gesellschaft, which was the immigration group, had purchased a great church library and had printed and bound 900 copies of Luther's Catechism. A large collection of printed sheet music for church was acquired, including a complete organ, which was purchased for 350 thalers in Dresden. Even a church orchestra had been provided with a full set of instruments. The records, still extant, this was in the 20s, so they're not extant anymore, reports the purchase of a bass viol, a cello, 7 violins, 2 flutes, 2 oboes, 2 French horns, 2 trumpets, and 1 trombone. They were lovers of music, that company of Lutheran Saxons. Several pianos were shipped as freight. So this was all important to bring over, which was all kind of curated by Valter. Now, that should be clarified that many of those, including the pipe organ, was on the smaller ship, the Amelia, which sank. Now, if some of you have heard, I'm sure some of you have, that this organ survived, this organ came to St. Louis, and it's in Venedy, Illinois. This is not the case. Okay, if you've heard that, the organ of Venedy is not an organ that came over from Germany. And I have an article in, well, 2 articles, because one wasn't enough, in Concordia Historical Institute Quarterly coming out at the end of the year that will explain exactly why the organ in Venedy was not the one. The organ that Valter had built in Saxony sank, along with all the people. It was a very sad time. But the point is, they brought all of these instruments over. Music was very important. Not all of this was liturgical. This would have been, you know, for their community and home and all of this. So music was important to them. It was not an afterthought. And to that we can credit Valter and his brother, Otto Hermann, whom we would probably know better than CFW had he lived. But he actually composed a collection of poems or songs entitled Songs of the Exiles Upon the Sea. This was a thing to do back in the 19th century if you were leading your group. I have a book about Texas Lutheran music history, and the fellow who brought them over also composed some of the same title, Songs of Exiles. You know, so that was something you did. Otto, his brother, was a significant musician, and he wrote this. And this, again, references the ship that sank. Lord Jesus, Lord Jesus, the ship has not come. The ship named Amalia is missing. When wilt thou, O pilot, convey her back home from the storms that are howling and hissing? Have we, Lord, been favored thy mercies to share? Was their ship too small for thy kindness and care? Lord Jesus, come, still all our yearning, and hasten Amalia's returning. I granted her prayer for kindness and care. She was not too small for tempest and squall. My love went with her assailing, my power and presence prevailing. My sheep, neither hopeless nor craven, were led to a beautiful heaven. It's a lovely sort of poem and hymn, and also a tribute to the people on this ship and what they represented. With Otto and CFW, Valter, and that first immigration came, essentially, we're calling him the first cantor in the Missouri Synod. We can define this in different ways where he might not actually be the first cantor in the Missouri Synod, but because he existed before the Missouri Synod did. But this was Johann Friedrich Ferdinand Winter. He was the first cantor in the Missouri Synod, and he worked in Altenburg, Missouri. Has anybody been there? Yeah, it's a pretty significant place. He was a very humble fellow. He's the first personage in my first chapter. This, of course, was where the log cabin was, the Concordia College, where the Altenburg debate was. Everybody settled here. But he was trained, classically trained as a teacher and a musician. And he curated the Altenburg Manuscript, the collection of sacred and secular work, both new and from the canon, meaning Mozart, Haydn, established works like that, for use in the Lutheran colonies. And if you go down to that really nice museum down in Altenburg and ask to see the Winter Manuscript, they will know exactly what you're talking about. Now, sadly, the original Winter Manuscript was lent to somebody's grandma or something and is no longer with us. But somebody made a copy in the 60s. And so all we have is this copy. And it's a partitur, which in this essence doesn't mean part book, but it's just a collection of songs for men's choir. And this is really the first representation of Lutheran collections of music in the Missouri Synod in the United States. And here's some examples of which, not the easiest to read. But we come then to C.F.W. Walter as a musician. There hasn't been a lot of work on him, and I think that should be rectified in terms of his music and liturgical proclivities, because before his seminary training, he considered becoming a musician. As with most clergy of his time, he was educated in both musical theory and performance. But, maybe I shouldn't say but, also, he bore a pietistic aesthetic, and he encouraged the use of classical sacred music, both liturgically and in performance, but in a very careful way, and not necessarily in a modern way. I'll get into that. But here, you see, is the copy of the dedication service of the First Trinity Church in St. Louis. You see here, it's very interesting, because we don't often think how the Lutherans in the 19th century actually worshiped. Did they have, well, they had their hymnals, right? They had their liturgy mostly in their head, but they didn't really have bulletins like we have or prepared orders of service. But in this case, for a big, huge occasion, they printed the order of service. So this was December 3rd and 4th, 1865. And you can see, I apologize for this is from CHI, and I didn't really want to open it too much. So I didn't get flat pictures. I didn't want to disturb the manuscript, but you can see enough of his liturgy and see what he sings. But the important thing where we get to here is that, see on page 5 over here, a motet with a motet of instrumental arrangement by Mozart. You know, and then he has a text of the motet. I really haven't been able to identify it because it's likely Walter's own translation of the Latin, and I can't quite figure out what he was referring to here. But this is important. Walter, he knew Mozart, he knew Haydn. There's other examples of that. These were important exemplars of church music for him to establish in the early Missouri Synod. Remember, it had been established 1847. This is 1865. So these are still really relatively early in the Missouri Synod's existence. And this is what he's establishing as good church music. Of course, Walter himself also composed 4 songs, hymns, not really hymns, more like songs. Songs. And what's his most famous one? Yeah, right. He's risen, he's risen. So he wrote these 4 at the same time. He was stressed or something, and he had to go to Germany to recover. So he wrote these. In the original manuscripts, he wrote them. He was in the Gulf of Mexico, then he was in Cuba, then he was in Florida. So you can track where he was. It's like when you go on your cruise and you have your map on your TV screen. Well, he did that with his hymns, you know. So, the 4th one, of course, is the one that we all know, Erstanden, Erstanden ist Jesus Christ, which is a bit different than it comes to us. Because if any of you were at Peter Reske's lecture this morning, he talked about the Leisen, that old Kyrie Eleison, which became Eleison. And Walter wrote this Eleison again at the end. Erst an den Ostern, dann ist Jesus Christ, erfreue sich, was denn ist. Es jauchzte der Himmel mit seinem Herr, erhöhtet ihr Berge und braune Meer. Kyrie Eleison, Kyrie Eleison. See that at the end? We don't sing that. That got cut off. But I think that's interesting. In this way, at least, he's connecting it to a historical form of church music. I think, in general, these were not meant to be sung in church. He was very particular about the type of music he wanted in church, and this does not sound like anything that he would approve of. But, nonetheless, a great creative work. So the first hymnal of the Missouri Synod, published in 1847, was initiated by Walter, who wished congregations to have chorales of pure theology driven by their original rhythmic melodies, and that's a whole other story. But Walter promoted vigorous congregational singing and was very particular as to how organists led hymn singing. He decried dragging tempos and wandering Zwischenspiele, interludes between verses, which were rather ubiquitous of the area. Originally, the interludes were between phrases of the hymn, and that's what he was actually really objecting to. The interludes between, say, stanza one and two, those continued well into the 20th century. But he did not want the interstanzaic interlude. He thought they interfered with comprehension, which arguably they do. But his Kirchen Agenda of 1886, the agenda, established a liturgy which the Missouri Synod would employ well into the 20th century in some quarters, especially if you spoke German. This liturgy follows roughly Luther's Deutsche Messe, but Walther sought to purify the liturgy from the influence of rationalism, amalgamating the best elements of various Saxon agenda. He also assembled some basic musical elements in a liturgical beilage, appendix in the end. There's a lot to say about this, which we're not. But the point is that he established an early firm role in establishing the trajectory of the music and liturgy in the LCMS, which is not surprising. Walter was kind of, he had an ego, and he was very driven by his vocation. But he sought to establish this. And I think this is also overlooked. He was acclaimed as the premier organist in the Missouri Synod. Now, he was kind of the premier everything in the Missouri Synod, and that was something that he liked to cultivate. But I think there's a lot of truth in here. Reverend Carl Eisfeld says, he was a master at the organ. On the high festivals, he usually played the organ at Old Trinity, and it was a rare treat to listen to the wonderful improvisations, which admirably served to create in the audience the proper devotional spirit. Per Strömer actually wrote this as an autobiographical novel. He says, Walter acted, Per Strömer was a student at Concordia, acted as organist in the church nearest a seminary. Then the students who had missed being present were always very put out at not having known that he was to play. Theo Bunger says, on high festivals when he was not preaching, Walter would take to the organ bench, and worshipers in Holy Cross Church had no need to look who was playing when he sounded the prelude and auf mein Herz mit Freuden pealed forth with Easter joy. William Dahman remembers, it was easy to listen to him and also to his masterly playing in the organ of Holy Cross Church. There's one other fellow, I think maybe. Sometimes you can tell more about what your enemies say about you than what your friends say about you. And this one fellow, J.L. Gruber, I'm not terribly sure who he was, other than he was an antagonist of Walter. He insinuated some faint praise. He says, at the request of the congregation, if Walter was not required to be elsewhere, he would play the organ on Sunday in Trinity Church, at which time he had nothing in front of him except the chorale book. That's the hymnal accompaniment edition. For his postludes, he selected a short, simple theme, which he treated fugally in all possible keys with full organ. The modulations, which followed closely upon one another, and the transitions bestowed upon his playing a hard, powerfully loud, and bizarre character. He ignored the expression pedal as a matter of principle. He never used the upper manual, or has, if he did, it escaped my memory. And the secondary manual is where you play the interludes in 19th century performance practice. So that actually may mean he didn't do a lot of hymn accompanying. He might have just done a lot of preludes and postludes, because you only use the top manual for interludes. So, and this is an interesting story. Edmund Soil addressed Walter's reputation as an organist. He writes, "On the ancient Holy Cross organ, it was my honor in 1883 to play for services, pinch hitting for my old friend H. Eric, who at the time was incapacitated with rheumatism. At the dinner table on the first of such Sundays, I remember saying that I thought I'd manage pretty well playing that service, though I confess being a little rattled by noticing that Dr. Walter was watching my feet from a chair next to my bench. Eric burst out with the solicitous inquiry whether I had asked Walter to play the postlude. I confessed that I had not, whereupon he almost speechlessly, except to gasp out that I committed a grievous faux pas, because that was an honor always accorded to and expected by Walter. So the next time Walter sat next to me at the organ bench, I apologized for my ignorance of the custom and tried to make amends by asking him to play. He forgave me quite graciously, but declined my invitation." So I think we see how Walter curated the early, the importance of good church music, good organ playing in the early Missouri Synod. And that led, of course, to the development of the Addison Seminary, whose first director was Christian August Thomas Zelle. He was a Saxon immigrant of little formal schooling himself. He was appointed director of Addison in 1864, Walter saying he was the man of my choice. In addition to singing, Zelle taught organ, piano, and violin, the primary instruments of a Lutheran school teacher and parish musician. So if you're not familiar with the way Lutheran education was in the 19th century and, say, the Addison Seminary, this nice, lovely building here, you went to the Addison Seminary. It was like high school. And, you know, actually in the early days, there was all manner of children to adults. And you got your basic training basically to be a teacher. And integral with that training to be a teacher was a training to be a church musician. In various ways, organ training, singing. It varied through the years, both in quality and in the classes they taught. But the idea was that the parish musician, the parish teacher would be the parish musician. You really only needed one of them. Every LCMS church desired to have a school that would need a teacher, that they would then supply the musical needs to. So this was kind of a heady, weighty endeavor, I mean, just as a goal. Settle writes, "Half the classes were assigned to me, and I had to prepare during the free time. But the nearly constant sound of organs, pianos, and violins, of students practicing different pieces of music, compounded by many errors and dissonances, echoed and resounded within the old frame house. In this deafening and brain-damaging din, I was supposed to study. How often I sat with both hands convulsively clutching my hair and exclaiming, 'Am I destined to lose my last bit of reason?' But teaching was a pleasure for me, especially also that of voice." This is his account of the early years at the Addison Seminary. And I think he tells us here what they teach: organ, piano, violin, and voice. And violin was always an important instrument from the very beginning, because you would be assigned to a church and they wouldn't necessarily have an organ or a piano, and so you need to be familiar with violin. I think River Forest, which is what Addison became, I think they had that requirement till 1905. They finally, I guess by that time, churches had pianos and organs and there wasn't reason for a violin requirement. But this was his job. his job to teach everything. This was, I guess, true classical education. He was teaching Greek, Latin, music, everything. He continues, "It is not surprising that acknowledged authorities give the teaching of singing a place next to the teaching of theology in matter of importance. As Luther says, a schoolmaster must be able to sing, otherwise I will not look at him. But how do we judge a teacher who can sing well, but does not like to sing to his children, and in his teaching of them is satisfied only in having them recite a few hymn stanzas badly before the start of school?" So the idea of this Addison boarding school would be that the students would have a command of hymnody and basic performance, being able to lead church singing. He wrote in 1872, "The teacher's job is to cultivate spiritual singing among the dear youth and to promote congregational song with a flock of children entrusted to him. In what better hands, therefore, could the instrument of the church be than in which a called servant of the church in the most important of her offices, that the same, with sufficient talent and formation, is also a man after the heart of God, filled with the Spirit, who enlightens the church, heals it, and receives it with Christ Jesus in the right united faith, and who is a master of her praise and song. How highly our dear synod values the office of organist is shown by the fact that it has spent and still spends large sums of money to the end that artistic schoolmen should be trained as organists as possible. So this meant that he was overworked. And this leads us to Karl Brauer, who was the first full-time music professor in the Missouri Synod. And there's been very little work of him. And before I encountered him in Connie Seddon's archive, I really hadn't heard of him before. And it's kind of sad, because he was appointed in 1867 with the endorsement of Walter. All he did was teach music, organ, piano, violin, singing. He advocated for new organs at the seminary, initiating the purchase of a Pfeffer organ, Walter's preferred builder, after 1865, because Walter had a Pfeffer organ installed at Trinity St. Louis. In the Addison Schulblatt, a monthly periodical for Lutheran teachers, Zella and Brauer routinely recommended and advocated certain organ and choral music, including the forgotten music of Johann Sebastian Bach. So we remember that Walther didn't include Bach in that dedication service and this of Trinity in 1865. And this shouldn't surprise us, because this was not, Bach had been forgotten by this time. Although the Bach revival was happening in Europe by Mendelssohn, it hadn't made its way over. And so Bach was not a part of our vocabulary, he wasn't a part of our repertoire. And so Brauer sought to bring us back to Bach. Did anybody know these Schulblatts? They became Lutheran education. They're still published by Concordia Chicago. It's Lutheran Education now, isn't it? No. Lutheran Education, yeah. So, yeah, Lutheran Education Journal, I knew, yeah. So this is, it goes back to the 1860s. And Brauer started copiously writing on liturgical topics, how to play for a service, what to play, advocating Bach. And this was received by, supposedly, every teacher in the Missouri Synod. So he really became quite prolific and influential. He had this organ installed at the Addison Seminary aula. This is 1912. This picture was 1912. The organ was installed in 1887. It was the premier teaching instrument of the Missouri Synod. There were organs before that. And in my article in Concordia Historical Institute, quarterly at the end of the year, I document what each organ was. If you're, good care for your insomnia, I suppose. But this was one of the last instruments that he designed for Addison. But his most important contribution was his Mehrstimmiges Choralbuch, published by CPH in 1888. Anybody know this book? Yeah. Yeah. So, just to establish, we didn't really have, you know what our hymnals look like. It really made me sad to come here and not have all my visual aids, but I you know, with my hat and cape and all, I couldn't fit all my books on the plane, so I didn't bring it. But you know those 19th century hymnals. They don't have music, do they? So what did your organist do? Originally, and, well, you use Liam, but the organist had to assemble his, and I say his because they were mostly men at this point in history. They had to assemble their own accompaniment, their own interludes, and this is when you had all manner of different forms of the melodies floating around. You had rhythmic, you had non-rhythmic, you had variations within those. And it was the organist's job to figure out in whatever literature he had what he was going to play for the pastor's hymns each Sunday. And you can imagine that this is kind of confusing. So the chorale book here is just a collection of unified SATB, not meant to be sung SATB, but meant to be played SATB harmonies. Brower writes about his chorale book, "In order to promote church hymnody, it's necessary that artful cantors and organists employ the appropriate tunes and the manner in which they have established themselves in many years. For this purpose, it's necessary to have a complete collection as possible in the hands of those who would learn, which they can later employ in the service of their own congregation." President Krauss of Addison affirmed the pedagogical purpose of the chorale book. He stated, "If the congregation is to learn to sing, it must always hear the same melody and harmony. And if a member of the congregation from Baltimore or Omaha is to sing properly and without offense in a Lutheran congregation in Chicago," I think I'm already confused, "the organists in Baltimore, Chicago, and Omaha must present the chorales in the same way, with one melody, one rhythm, and harmony. Otherwise, confusion will result." So this was what Brower, and there's another fellow by the name of Heinrich Helter who did the same thing 2 years before, but Brower's chorale book was better, sold better. It meant to allay some of this confusion so that we could all play from the same thing. And interestingly, I have two copies of this book. There's a copy in the library here. I just checked the other day. I have two copies of this book in my library. I have no idea how I got them. But to me, it shows that there was a lot published. Many of them are published. They're still floating around. They're not rare. So that means that they were used. They were significant. So when Krauss writes this about Brower at the end of his career, "I'm equally certain that every cantor and organist who has emerged from our seminary over the last 25 years, who now has charge of their own church and school, owes much to your training. No one who disfigures the beautiful things of God by unchurchly organ playing, or by empty sing-song or clitter-clatter, who may labor under the title of choir director, can blame you for their misdeeds." No, he didn't learn that from you. It kind of makes you wonder what was going on out there. On a totally unrelated note, I hear there's a silent movie tonight. Brower always used his wonderful musical gifts and knowledge for the glory of God and for the edification of his dear church. He had trained hundreds of talented organists and cantors. Under his direction, they not only acquired the necessary technical skills, but also strove as a connoisseur of proper church music to instill the right attitude in his servants. Students, they mastered the organ themselves, learning from him how properly to play the organ in church. I think he was very important. This brings to mind what Buzin said. There are some musicians who have been forgotten, perhaps rightfully so, and some that should not have. And I think Brower's legacy is one that deserves to be remembered because he certainly was influential. Even if you weren't his direct organ student, you probably read his articles in the Schulblatt, which encouraged you to seek out Bach, which wasn't easy to find. The scores weren't easy to find. But he told you where to order them from. I think he's been quite overlooked, and I've enjoyed learning about him. Lochner, one of my favorite characters, Friedrich Lochner said this: "Why shouldn't the parish school teacher be the most suitable person for the office of organist in most cases. Not only is he himself a member of the church community, and not only are the offices of the school teacher and the church organist branches of one and the same tree, auxiliary offices of the sacred office of the word, both serving to make the word grow hither, but is also a principal duty of the Christian school teacher to cultivate spiritual singing among the dear youth and to promote congregational singing to the flock of children entrusted to him. In what better hands, therefore, could the instrument of the church be than in which a called servant of the church and the most important of her branches, that the same, with sufficient talent and formation, is also a man after the heart of God, filled with the Spirit, who enlightens the church, heals it, and receives it with Christ Jesus in the right united faith, and who is a master of her praise and song. Now, Lochner was, for many of his years, at Trinity, Milwaukee. Then later he was at Springfield, then he retired back to Trinity, Milwaukee, where he instituted a program of complete liturgical reform, essentially, where he advocated with his organist, Christian Dietz was his name, he advocated chanting of the liturgy, which wasn't particularly done much at that time, the rhythmic chorales, speeding them up. That's two different issues, but rhythmic chorales and speeding them up so the congregation could sing. He and Dietz did this over a period of several years until the congregation, basically, congregation kind of thought that it was their idea, the congregation's idea to do this, and they were quite happy with it and voted that they were never going to do it any other way but sing the rhythmic chorales. So he has this, the Liturgy for the Holy Communion, where he found ancient sources, which to us are now familiar. But this is different than Walter's liturgy of 1856, and he has four-part settings of this, his settings of the Psalms. Again, these are all in at the Concordia Historical Institute. There's a lot of this. This really wasn't necessarily a part of my research, but if you're interested in Lochner, there's a lot. He was one of the Sendlings. Just interested in all manner of music and art. And of course, this organ at Trinity, Milwaukee, the Schulke organ, which he basically designed along with Christian Dietz, and hope that they can rebuild this soon. But of course, his Hauptgottesdienst of 1895 stands as his most important work. It he delves into liturgical theology, history, sources, and recommended performance practices for organists. He tells you what to accompany, he tells your pastor what to chant, what not to chant, what the organist should accompany. He says, I'm motivated in doing so not solely by a desire to serve the students, which were assigned to the practical field of theological instruction, more aptly than was possible through individual brief lectures, but also by misgiving that the old form of the divine service, which has now come into use again, may be endangered in the future. Toward the prevention of such danger, then, I hereby desire to contribute this present liturgical work. So it was almost an apology for a repristinated liturgical approach. There's something else I wanted to say about Lochner. He was a liturgical scholar, a professor, hymnologist, but he writes this, and I think it's a good example of a pastoral approach, and I'm no good at this, but he was better at it. He says, after 26 years of service at one of our old congregations, which was not only advanced in knowledge, but also ritually appointed liturgically, which he did himself, Trinity, Milwaukee, I was installed in a congregation that was not yet fully ripe for the old liturgy, so that even chanting at the altar had to be dispensed with for a time. Although I was unable, in the context of the divine service in the congregation, to demonstrate to my students all that I had gave them in liturgical instruction, I was able to some extent to show them that how a good Lutheran preacher preaches when it comes to the proper forms and respect to liturgical matters. But I had to be patient for a time, and while having great love for the old liturgy and all enthusiasm for it, it's still possible by God's grace to say with Paul in this respect, I can face both abundance and need through him who strengthens me, even Christ. So that's an interesting way of describing this richly liturgical church at Trinity, Milwaukee. And then he went to Springfield to teach, and the congregation there had not benefited from his 25 years of liturgical enrichment, and how he adapted. You know, he didn't try to change them all at once. I just think it's a very good lesson to have. Matthew Carver has a translation of this, the Chief Divine Service from CPH, which I'd really recommend if you're interested in it. It's a great source. But when I was researching at CHI, I realized that Lochner was actually quite a fine artist. This is the first Trinity Church in St. Louis, which he did a watercolor of. And then there's some others. I suppose he witnessed a hot air balloon over the Mississippi one time. I don't know. And people walking in the rain. This fellow was very interesting. This is what I wanted to kind of show, that these are real people too. You wonder who this was doing the wash. During winter, I suppose. I wonder if this is supposed to be Mary, Jesus, and Joseph, because they're not dressed like St. Louis people, any that I know of. And it looks like a palm tree over there, too. I don't know. It's pretty interesting. And there's his house, his retirement house in Milwaukee. Now, this takes us, and we're going to go pretty fast now. Capel, who's heard of him? Heard of him? Yeah. So Capel was called, he was for a number of years at Trinity St. Louis. He was a teacher, parish musician, composed a number of choral and organ works, but he preferred psalm settings, none of which have been published, and I think that's quite a shame. I mean, they're at the CHI archive down there. But he kind of grew as a church musician at Trinity St. Louis. He edited these Liederperlen editions. Does anybody have these? Yeah. Somehow I have three of them. I don't know where they came. Two that look like this and one that's a larger copy. I have no idea where they came from. But he collected these song pearls, literally what it is. But little, I guess we'd say little gems, song gems. But they're meant to be sung at Sunday school and at home, a way of inculcating good singing in the family life. But he was called to, he graduated from Edison, but then was called to replace Karl Brauer. He retired, I think it was 1897. Yeah, it was 1897, after which time Capel came to River Forest. And then, of course, he was there during the transition from Edison to the current campus in River Forest. And here's the organ, picture of the organ he designed. I don't know where this would have been on the campus. Any idea? You know, kind of interesting organ. Not AGO standard pedal board. But he, in 1911, he wrote an instruction manual for his students at River Forest and for his service playing class, the Orgel and Gottesdienst, which is really important if you're interested, like I am. Maybe only three people are, but I am, in how you would play a 19th century German service. It is not very easy. You have to play interludes. You have to do, a pastor is never given the pitch. You have to establish elegantly a pitch. Whether the pastor will chant elegantly was a totally different matter, but you had to establish everything in complete elegance. Again, it probably didn't happen this way, but this was the ideal. So you had to modulate. You didn't just end a hymn. You had a Schluss, a closing at the end. You had a introduction, you had interludes between stanzas, and in Capel's Orgel im Gottesdienst, he tells you exactly what to do. This is using Walter's liturgy of 1856. We're not talking about the common service, we're not talking about TLH, but this is the German service, as you see, the Orgel im Gottesdienst. He did a number of limited compositions for organ, as you see here. And I played a concert at the chapel in St. Louis last September, and I played a couple of these. They sound like Mendelssohn or Brahms, just kind of that mid-19th century aesthetic. Capel's legacy. He was one of the first organists in our synod who gave recitals in our churches, and he acquainted our people with Bach and other great composers. Capel was a man of lovable, noble Christian character, a congenial colleague, and a true and faithful friend. This next one, this is a CPH wrote this about him. Capel deserves the popularity he enjoys as a composer for the church organ. He deserves even greater popularity than he does enjoy. So I think he was a fairly modest fellow and didn't do a lot of self-promotion. Taking the Martin Lochner, who was Friedrich Lochner's son. He, of course, went to Addison, and then he was called to Emmanuel Lutheran College in Greensboro, North Carolina, where he had this nice organ to play. It's a Kilgan organ, actually. Only picture I could find of it. So he comes from this, you know, the Lochner family has a long lineage, I think, really back to Luther, if you ask them about it. There's a lot of Lochners were all pastors and church musicians. They had just a wondrous lineage. And Martin, of course, knew that, and he continued this. I think this is his thesis explored the history of two names of the 1912 Lutheran hymnal. Is anybody familiar with this work? So essentially, this is the history of two names of the 1941 hymnal, too, because there weren't that many changes. Well, maybe you would know, but Elizabeth. Yeah. But if you find a tune in TLH, you can go to Lochner here, and he'll tell you, chances are it's there. Actually, you probably can't go to Lochner because I had the interlibrary loan this, so I have it digitally. So if anybody wants it, I'm the one that has it. It's kind of interesting. It shows you that hymnology is beginning to become a thing, the study of church music. So the Schulblatt was now called the Lutheran School Journal, and Lochner was appointed music editor. He writes, "When you're planning your Christmas music, take the school journal, turn to the music department and see what's suggested. Let this department help you plan your work. If it fails to give you the assistance you need, feel free to tell the department editor, Professor Lochner, wherein, according to your opinion, the service may be improved." So this is practical writings, practical instructions for church musicians in the Missouri Synod. Now, Capel had written an organ, the Orgeln Gottesdienst, the organ in the divine service. So Lochner decided he needed to write one too. He was a student of Capel. So he wrote this organist handbook for his service flank classes at River Forest. Its content is largely practical and aimed toward organists, but he borrowed quite a bit from his father's, their Hauptgottesdienst, and sections word for word translated from Capel's The Orgeln Gottesdienst. He'd never be allowed to get away with this sort of thing these days, but no. So he actually tells you how to play the English service. So what would become the common service and how you would use it in TLH. But he also tells you how to play the German service with the interludes, modulations, that sort of thing. So there's a long tradition at River Forest of service playing and publishing manuals how to do so. He served at Grace Lutheran, where Paul Mons and Walter Peltz were two of his students. And I have a really great quote here about that Paul Mons remembers Lochner. Maybe I shouldn't say this. Well, I think I will. Paul Mons' experience studying at Concordia during the late 1930s illustrates the tension so prevalent between the more progressive and the traditional manner of service playing. He writes, "I would play for chapel in the old chapel, known on campus as the aula, upstairs. And I remember once, the first time, Paul Mons wrote this, I should say. I got chewed out terribly by Martin Lochner. You didn't play what was written. And later I was playing again. I didn't play that often for chapel because all the organists were going to be teachers had to play for chapel, so perhaps once every 3 months. He really chewed me out again. You have to play exactly what's written, nothing more and nothing less. And I have to say this, I had complete freedom in my own mind how to harmonize to him. I watched the harmonic rules. They were instinctive in my memory, but they were different, and that's what Lochner was objecting to." So as we move into the 20th century, you see this tension between, you know, service playing and how the organist presents themselves. And we'll wrap up. Who knows Albert Beck? Yeah, well, not personally, but. So he was the father of Theodore Beck, of course, who's much better well-known these days. But again, continuing with this Addison lineage, he began school at Addison, but graduated in 1914 with the first class after the school had moved to River Forest, where he was appointed to the faculty upon graduation. And even though that sounds really wonderful, he was appointed teacher in geography, penmanship, and music. Which penmanship was a very big thing back in the day. I mean, lots of professors, they started teaching their first years teaching penmanship. I didn't know this, but looking through old yearbooks, you find that this is truly the case. So Beck was kind of a star student, which is why he was hired at graduation. He established a formal choir program at River Forest. He promoted and performed Bach, both choral and organ works. Again, we see a difference from the 19th century. He wrote these motets in English and German in a simple style, simple enough for a parish choir to sing. His organ compositions included 76 offertories on hymns and chorales suited to the pericope for each Sunday of the church year. Again, this is the first time you see this arrangement of an organ collection, not just chorales. These are arranged according to the liturgical year.
I still have a book of his which I play out
all the time. You do? 36
Preludes.
This one. Oh, 36.
36
I inherited it from an old organist. I think that's the one I have too. I found it on eBay. Yeah. It was very sad. Somebody wrote on Facebook, it was the Lutheran Ladies League. It's one that Sarah Golseth does. I'm not in it, but my wife is in it. And she said somebody wrote recently that she had 3 volumes of Albert Beck in her car, and her car was stolen. And she really didn't care about her car, but she needed those 3 volumes of Albert Beck. And I don't really know which ones they were, but I have 2 of them digitized. And so I've offered to send her. I can't help her with her car, but.
I play out of the 36 Preludes before every funeral I play. And I've had to go from one, you know, there's a certain series I do, and they're wonderful, you know.
Yeah, they sound mid-20th century, you know, or early 20th century. They're practical. We see practicality, exactly. Moving on, Walter Wismar. Wismar's career was spent at Holy Cross, St. Louis. I included Wismar because he is a parish musician. He wasn't associated with a university. He wasn't a concert performer. But he shows what the parish musician can do. It was the Kilgan organ at Holy Cross around 1920. He did direct the St. Louis Seminary Chorus, peaking in membership in 1926 at 175. I mean, can you imagine the administrative work involved with that, much less directing. They became the symphony chorus for St. Louis, performing Liszt's superb Faust symphony for some reason. In 1924, Wismar spoke to Lutheran youth groups around the nation about the importance of singing Lutheran chorales. He took an informal survey of the favorite hymns of young people and was horrified by the results. Number 1, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. Rock of Ages, Abide With Me, A Mighty Fortress, Just As I Am, Jesus, Lover of My Soul, Savior, I Follow On, Near My God to Thee. In the hour of trial, I'm but a stranger here, etc., etc. Yes. Concordia Publishing House wasted no time capitalizing on Wismar's survey, and these items appeared on November 4, 1924. Favorite Hymns of the Church series. Each hymn has individual designs lithographed in full colors, initials and titles in gold. Lead Kindly Light, Abide With Me, Jesus Lover of My Soul, Rock of Ages, The Lord's Prayer, Dr. Martin Luther's Battle Hymn, and the 23rd Psalm. So, not all of those are terrible, but. Well, when I should probably move on, but he has in the Concordia Historical Institute archive, Wismar has several years of, he wrote down each service he did, what he played, what the choir sang, and I just find it very interesting. These are copies from what he did. His own composition, Psalm 100. This was an amazing work for children's choir, adult choir, brass, never been published, because probably nobody would ever do it, but he had many people in his choir. Rechlin! Who knows Rechlin? Yeah. I included him because he was the first Missouri Synod organist to study in Europe with Guimond and Charles-Marie Vidor. His early career was characterized by recitals received to great acclaim as opposed to his later career. But, yeah, he performed throughout Europe. The notable house organist to several wealthy families. He played at Joseph Pulitzer's mansion many times. Went to Europe, traveled with them. He penned an article in 1924, The Publicity Value of Organ Music. No, I'm not trying to do that. Some years ago, the suggestion that Lutheran organ music might serve tremendously in the cause of Lutheran publicity would have seemed to the writer to be in the nature of a rather curious, perverted humor. But now, having been engaged in just that species of Lutheran publicity work, he has not merely become convinced of its value, but can point to convincing statistics in the matter. Publicity, in order to be of constructive result, requires a valuable and necessary article which is to be brought to the attention of those to whom it's addressed. And in its organ music, the Lutheran Church possesses a heritage and treasure unequaled in the history of music. This is automatically guaranteed by its chief figure, Johann Sebastian Bach, and other immortals. So we see where now Rechlin is taking this mantle of Bach. We've gone from Bach not being a personage of any importance to being very important. He received a doctorate from Valparaiso in 1936. And we'll conclude with two people from Seward, Carl Hasse, a music professor here. At St. John's, too. He navigated the choir through perilous times, including the global influenza pandemic of 1918-20. Sound familiar? Addressing the choir before its annual song service in 1920. During the last 2 years, our choir has been suffering severely from the effects of the flu, so that it seemed we would have to bury the choir. But since the disappearance of this dangerous malady, a new era for the choir has begun. Until about 100 years later, then he had to do it all again. So he established a number of things here. We're not going to have time to go into them. But what I really wanted to say about Hasse, this is a great picture. Those tubas are just wonderful. He designed 6 organs here, 2 for the chapel, 1 pre and post fire. This is why he's important. He composed for instruments, choir, and organ. His most important contributions were his settings of every hymn tune in the Lutheran hymnal, anticipating what would come next in the Concordia Hymn Prelude series. So this is the first time this was done. You know, so we have this transition from just basic chorale preludes to hymns of the day to now every single hymn in TOH. And finally, we have my favorite person. Can I do him in less than 0 minutes? No. But it's Theodor Stelzer, who was here. He studied with Wilhelm Mittelschulte, who is a very acclaimed organist in Chicago. He wrote this symphonic double fugue with chorale on the Passion Chorale, which he dedicated to Mittelschulte and performed by him on his Germany tour in 1925. And Dr. Fabi, the archivist here, sent me this. I thought, oh, this will be a fun piece. I can transcribe it and play it. And then it kind of looks like this. And I got past the first page, and I thought, I can't tell what this thing is. But this was performed by Mittelschulte. He very much respected Stelzer. I think, you know, to have someone outside of the Missouri Synod play and perform a professor's music from here, he actually performed this at Notre Dame one time too. And that's quite amazing and shows where Lutheran music has gone. He was appointed here in 1927, teaching subjects from music to PE. He accumulated various degrees, including a PhD in psychology and measurements from the University of Nebraska. He succeeded Lochner as musical editor of the Lutheran School Journal. His articles, read by nearly every teacher in the Missouri Synod, dealt with all manner of pedagogy. And here is, you know, when you have that Sunday, like Lutheran School Sunday, here you can sing the Motet on Christian Education by Theodore Steltzer. Apparently, I mean, this is a very long piece. It's just a motet on Christian education. It combines Bible verses, and it's very interesting. See, it keeps going and going. He edited the Stelzer Song Series. You have this book, and compiled a book for teaching even younger children to sing. This was an important book. This was an important book. According to former student Dr. George Nielsen, Stelzer's life was the personification of the theme. His calling was to prepare teachers for Lutheran schools. So teach where you are needed. If it is music, learn the discipline and teach it. If psychology, learn the discipline and teach it. So to conclude, what can we learn from these pioneers of Missouri Synod music? This is my opinion. Maybe you can conclude different things. All had been thoroughly catechized in Lutheran doctrine and practice from an early age, including the chorale, forming their vernacular liturgical language. With the exception of Racline, which I'm going to cover him in my book, and I'll say why, I just can't go into that now, all valued the Missouri Synod, or the Synodical Conference, as a culturally and spiritually closed ecosystem, either countering the prevailing American cultures completely or looking upon surrounding culture with great skepticism. They went, you see how they all graduated from the same institutions? This is one way. Their careers were largely comprehensive rather than focused. They trained to teach, but they branched into sacred and sometimes secular music, performance, and pedagogy. They were conversant in theology, polity, and even secular subjects. They aimed for the highest quality of church music, from rhythmic chorales to recommending quality organ music to composing Gebrauchsmusik pieces to fulfill a need, to training children in singing techniques. They all had church-wide visions for improvements. And they were marked by the utmost humility. If you want to know my two exceptions, you have to read my book later. They were modest in their views of their own attainments and skills, particularly in playing organ, and encouraged others to exhibit an attitude of service. They could have been more financially successful elsewhere, but they lived out their vocation of service to Christ and his church, even though it involved privations. And this is my favorite picture of Theodore Steltzer here. You survived this lecture. Now go out into the world proclaiming the gospel. Thank you.
Thank you for listening in to this recorded session from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Institute on Liturgy, Preaching, and Church Music. We hope you'll join us at one of our conferences in the future. Visit lcms.org/worship-institute for more information. lcms.org/worship-institute.